From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Two big upsets this week in Texas politics. A Latino high school teacher beats the party machine, and a Democratic turncoat loses as a Republican. April 15th, that's tax day, is just around the corner, but some citizens won't pay their federal taxes to protest the military budget. We'll talk with two war tax resistors. And Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, is still challenging militarism. He says the nuclear test ban should be a critical issue in the 1996 campaign.
This country, under Bill Clinton, would be testing nuclear weapons this month, just as France just finished doing. We would have been doing it before France. We would have been doing it for the last 3 years under Clinton, were it not for a grassroots effort and effective lobbying on Congress to keep Bill Clinton from doing that.
That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Let's see, how did USA Today put it? Will success spoil Victor Morales? A high school civics teacher and small-town councilman, Morales stunned the Texas political establishment Tuesday by defeating a seven-term congressman and earning the Democratic Senate nomination. Now facing the savvy and well-financed incumbent, GOP Senator Phil Graham, Morales must run a statewide campaign skilled enough to beat Graham in November without appearing to become a politician himself. And joining us right now to talk about his prospects is the man himself, Victor Morales, Democratic candidate for Senate from Texas. We're also joined by Jim Hightower, former editor of the Texas Observer, progressive populist, and author of the forthcoming book, There's Nothing in the Middle of the Road But Yellow Stripes and Dead Armadillos. I want to welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Victor Morales. Can you tell us, sir, what it is you stand for in Texas and what was the planks that you ran on?
I was simply an ordinary person who was tired and frustrated. And I was tired and frustrated of what we perceive as just political rhetoric. You've got like very complicated problems. And all I think, like many people told me, I'll just want the truth. You know, for example, they'd tell me, I know you're not going to go up there and fix all those problems, Victor, and the issues are many, but at least tell us the truth. You know, I think people just want to make sure that someone's going out there not to get rich or on a power trip, etc. So, I mean, I didn't have all these deep philosophical ideas, except that I always said, well, no one seems to be doing this, especially the senator we have now, so I said, I'll do it, and I took off. But as far as the issues I'm concerned, like many of us are about many things, education, welfare, the immigration, crime from a prevention standpoint, immigration from the rhetoric which attacks aliens and legal aliens. Yes, we know there's problems, but this mindset of attack is just going nowhere. So affirmative action, not time to get rid of it yet. Yes, there's, if you can find a place where it's been abused, let's reform, as President Clinton said a while back, but not time to get rid of it yet. So just a scattering issues. I know people had said, Victor, be sure to have three issues, get well-versed, and get on them and get on them. But when you're driving yourself across the state of Texas, as I did, for 60,000 miles plus in my truck, you don't have time to do a whole lot except meet the people, and I made that priority.
Right now, you'll be going up against Phil Graham. He's taken a very strong stance against abortion, also right. Known as a corporate politician, raised a tremendous amount of money for his campaign. What are your stands on abortion and on corporate power in this country?
I've always felt, I guess I've never been rich, so I don't really have an understanding of why sometimes it seems they feel so abused, you know. But I think I'll go back to a young man I met on the campaign trail who said, Victor, you've got to have a flat tax, okay? My uncle is a cardiologist. I said, had to pay $300,000 in taxes. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I guess I've been poor, I've been low income, and I'm middle class, and I just couldn't understand that. I go, if you had to pay $300,000, geez, let's trade jobs. You know, I don't see the problem there. I really don't. I mean, he took a lot out of society as well. As far as that's concerned, my outlook is of just the everyday citizen. And on abortion, unfortunately, many times people just want to tag you pro-choice, pro-life. So if they want that tag on me, I'm pro-choice. But like many other people who are pro-choice, we are disturbed by the high number of abortions. Maybe, again, from an educational standpoint, we can do something in high teenage pregnancy rates to bring them down. But if my wife and I feel adamantly that in case of incest or rape, a woman should have a choice of life endangerment, then we have, or my wife has made a choice, and then it's very difficult to go on and say, but not in your case.
As a result of your win, the mainstream media is talking about this as the increasing power of the Latino vote in Texas. You won with 80% support from Latino voters. Is that your interpretation?
Oh, it might be true, but I just go back to somebody originally when they asked me, will you be targeting the Hispanic vote? And I said, no, because I would be the U.S. Senator for everybody. And so I didn't. I hit them like I hit everybody else. I was all over the state. So of course, that's true that there's many Hispanics who, and I'm glad they're proud of me, voted for me because I'm Hispanic. But, you know, let's be realistic. There's also probably some people who voted against me for that. So I really don't consider, you know, think in those terms.
We're talking to Victor Morales, who is now the Democratic candidate for Senate from Texas. He beat out the long-term Democratic Congressmember John Bryant, who resigned from his seat to run for the Senate. We're also joined by Jim Hightower, longtime progressive commentator in Texas and also former agriculture commissioner there. Were you surprised, Jim, by Victor Morales' win?
Not really. I was surprised by his success. And first of all, congratulations, Victor. What a terrific race you made.
Thank you, Mr. Hightower.
I was surprised by his success in the first primary, but in the runoff, you know, as people get to know who he is and got to get a sense of him, and as I realized that this was a guy who was not going to hire consultants, I thought, hey, he's really got a chance. You know, they say, Mark Twain said that every now and then an innocent man gets sent to Congress, and I think that's what we've got in store for us, and it is a very exciting moment, not just for Hispanics, and I want to stress that. Victor ran one up in northeast Texas, the old populist section of the state, too, which is not a Hispanic stronghold in the state, and he ran strongly in every section of the state, and I think he did so because, as your listeners just heard probably for the first time, this is an honest guy. He just stepped forward and says, you know, there's a mess up there, and I don't know if I can handle it, but can I really do worse than those people who are now trying to handle it?
And
people said, hey, I think I'm for Victor.
Well, you know, I was talking to an AP reporter in Austin, Texas yesterday, and I was talking to him about Victor Morales, and I said, you know, is he easy to get in touch with? He said, oh, yes, he's very acceptable. So are his aides, his advisors, his campaign strategists. In fact, they're all him. They're all Victor Morales.
Now, well, Victor Morales and his family.
You know, my wife is helping a lot.
Exactly.
That's right. The one thing I saw about you on TV before the races began was that you had to drive around in a pickup truck for this campaign because she uses the van.
That's correct. And, well, we have a 9 and 10-year-old, so it's just logical that, you know, she needs that to get around.
Well, let me ask you something, Mr. Morales. Now, it seems that it certainly will change. I mean, the Democratic machine, the Democratic committee has been supporting your opponent, John Bryant. Well, now they're going to have to come behind you. Have those meetings begun?
Well, I'm right now with Senator Kerry. Well, I met with him yesterday afternoon. We went to a dinner and a fundraiser for his committee, and he mentioned about how they can help us. So we're just really starting to talk about that now.
Will you be hiring advisors? Will you be hiring aides, strategists?
Not strategists, not consultants, no. Maybe a campaign manager would be great, someone to take the load off of me so I can do what I like to do the best, and that is meet the people. And also read. That's been it's been a hardship on me. As a government teacher, I'm extremely well-read, normally, because I love to debate. I like to get in with the students and peers, etc. But driving, of course, has been a real hardship, and that was one of the criticisms about me at times, that, you know, I didn't seem to know all the issues. But then, in my defense, in the paper the other day, Senator Dole, I forget which day it was, they were talking about NAFTA, and they talked about how Mr. Buchanan asked him, well, would you vote for NAFTA? And Senator Dole said, not without some changes. And the gentleman said, well, what would you change? Well, we don't know that yet. Now, here's a man who's been up 30 years or plus and is well acquainted with the NAFTA bill, and he doesn't know some things. So I kind of take a little bit of offense of how in the world they expect me to have all these policies, you know, with nuts and bolts. I have a basic knowledge of being an ordinary man. I have a knowledge of the truth. I think that's more important.
Let me switch for a second to another upset this week. That was another upset of a party machine, and that's the Republicans. You had Congressmember Greg Laughlin, one of the Democratic congressmen who switched parties after the 94 GOP landslide, and his defeat is sure to embarrass national and state Republican Party leaders because they worked overtime to ensure his victory. Let me ask you, Jim Hightower, what about this race?
It was a moment of just glorious joy for me to see Greg Laughlin, this party switcher. Democrats were never that proud of Greg anyway. He's got the IQ of a leaf blower. And so for him then to switch parties, which he did just strictly out of opportunism, you know, he didn't switch parties when the Democrats were in power. He switched parties when the Republicans came to power. And then for him to, for the whole Republican establishment to come down there and hug him, I'm talking about Newt Gingrich, his own self came, George Bush, Shrub Bush, all the entire kit and caboodle that the Republican Party has came down there and hugged up on old Greg. And, you know, in Texas, all these endorsements don't mean a whole lot. In fact, if you get too many of them, as I think Greg did, Texans back up and say, well, there must be something wrong with this guy if they're all coming down there and hugging on him. So it was a glorious moment in which really the establishment just took a whack upside the head.
Now, the man that beat him, Ron Paul, had a number of endorsements as well. He had endorsements from people like, what, Phyllis Schlafly?
Right. Well, he's flakier than Mama's pie crust, and we're going to have a good time with him, we being the Democrats, going against him down there, because a guy named Charles Lefty Morris, a terrific guy, and he's not known lefty as Lefty because of his communist ties. He's known as Lefty because he used to be a left-handed ball player out in Big Spring, Texas. So he's another guy kind of up from the grassroots, just like Victor is. So maybe the Democratic Party is beginning to get its act together, putting some candidates forward that people can actually like.
But with Ron Paul, he was formerly with the Libertarian Party. Do you think libertarian politics is gaining popularity in Texas?
Well, there's always been a strong libertarian streak in Texas, even before there was a Libertarian Party. And in fact, libertarians, though they didn't call themselves that, and populists are what settled this state. So that streak is there alive and well, but I don't think it means much for the Libertarian Party per se. Particularly because Ron Paul, while he has some legitimate libertarian positions, he also has some just, further out than Pluto positions.
I see he also got the endorsement of economist Milton Friedman, and in addition to former Texas Rangers pitching ace Nolan Ryan, who managed his campaign.
Well, Milton Friedman, I don't know how many Texans know Milton Friedman. I'm not sure that's a big endorsement.
Well, let's go to Victor Morales again. What made you decide? I mean, what was the moment where you said, I think I'm going to run for Senate? Were you sitting in a classroom in your government civics class?
I actually was reading, or I had heard that morning, and I was reading, getting ready for the first class, about Mr. Graham running for president and some of the comments he was making, let's say, on affirmative action. And he was referring to him again as quotas. If I'm president, I'll get rid of these quotas, affirmative action, bingo, period. And this bothered me as an educator. I mean, I know there's a lot that I don't know, right? I'm not only a teacher, but also a learner. And I'm thinking, this man, in a powerful position such as this, is going around making simplistic statements like that to score political points. And that's wrong. Not only does he hurt people that he's against, but also his own people, and by keeping them ignorant with emotional touch-button statements, right? So at that time, that's when I said, geez, will someone take this guy on? And, of course, I knew everybody's talking about his money and everybody's scared of his power, et cetera, et cetera. But I made a few calls and to see if any of our officials were going to do it. Nobody was. I was talking to the students about it. And they said, well, why don't you do it? And I said, well, why not? And I jumped in my truck, did a little experimental summer tour whenever I could, because I had my 9 and 10-year-olds with me. I stay home with them every summer. And the reaction was great across the board, black, white, brown, old, young, rich, poor, didn't seem to matter. Very few people questioned my sanity. Everybody said, this is great, I love it. You know, and didn't Graham switch parties? It's funny y'all were talking about that, because
yep,
that was mentioned many times across the trip. Oh, yeah, that's the guy that jumped, you know, and I said, yeah, back in 83, that's right.
Well, let me put this question to both of you, and that is, some are saying that the Republicans are now leaping for joy, that Bryant ran on the, basically his main point was that he was the only Democrat who had a chance to beat Phil Gramm, being a many-term Democratic Congress member from Texas. What's your response to that, Victor Morales?
Well, that's the first time I've heard that. I mean, we've heard completely the opposite over here. Across the state, regular people and people a little bit involved would say there's no way. As a matter of fact, people have involved very much, I probably wouldn't want to be named, but they said there's no way that Bryant can win. I heard that over and over and over again. You're completely different. You might have a chance. Oh, there's still people. In fact, last night there was a gentleman at a fundraiser who said, Victor, you don't have a snowball hell of a chance of winning, you know. But I'm glad you're doing it. So you have those. But really, quite consistently, I heard Bryant has no chance. He has baggage, political baggage, that'll hurt him. Graham will do just the same thing as he did with the other two.
And I'm hoping that Graham just keeps listening to those experts who are telling him that Victor Morales doesn't stand a chance. And that story Victor just told there about the guy who says last night, well, you don't stand a snowball's chance in hell, Victor, but I'm for you. Well, that's being repeated all across the state. He doesn't have a chance, but I'm for him. Well, that's just the best political advertisement you can have.
Are you prepared for the onslaught, Mr. Morales? I mean, Phil Gramm is known as an extremely vicious campaigner.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I made a challenge the night that I won. I told him I challenged Phil Gramm to just go on his issues and what he thinks and on his record and man-to-man, do it like a man of respect. Of course, I know that might just be talking to the wind, but you can't prepare for anything like that. You can't prepare for ugly things in politics. That there's pain involved. The only thing I can say is I'm pretty tough and... I don't worry about myself so much. I do have family. But there's nothing I can do about it. I've made this step, and that should be part of it. I'll just continue the high road. But as I also mentioned, I hope they don't mistake my niceness for weakness, because I will fight back. I just won't get dirty.
What is your stance on immigration?
I've agreed with many people that we do need to control our borders, and it's always been... You know, again, perspective, it's always been a problem. You know, we've always had illegal aliens, and there's always been the thought of, oh, you remember the Irish? Oh, the Chinese? I mean, this is nothing new. It just seems we get up and attack the immigrants whenever there's certain problems. And so I say, yeah, let's protect our borders. And I had no problem when Clinton sent more border guards. But this Buchanan outlook of the fence and the horde, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, being a grandson of immigrants myself, I know there's a lot of contribution, a lot more than is talked about in this political rhetoric. So I can understand anger when all the taxpayers hear is about their abusing our health care system, our education system, but that's all they hear. They're not hearing about the tremendous amount of, for example, like a study that said, for example, that they, I think on average, this one particular study said bring in $2,000 more into our system than they take out. You know, you don't hear things like that. You just hear the attack mode.
Mr. Morales, you felt personally that you wanted to reveal that your father, who left your family when you were 15, is in jail because you said that people are going to find out anyway. Are you afraid about what this means for your family, the kind of exposure?
I don't know what I could do. I mean, the man left me when I was 15 or 16. I'm 46 years old. If people don't want to vote for me because of that, then so be it. It's kind of my attitude.
I think, Amy, that's going to help him. There's hardly a Texas family that doesn't have somebody who's been to jail.
Jim Hightower, would you like to give us a thumbnail sketch of Texas politics changing right now? I mean, from people like Laughlin losing to people like Victor Morales winning?
Well, I think it's a national picture, really, that Victor spoke the truth when he said that he got into politics because he was fed up, and that when he went around in his pickup truck and stopping at gas stations and the Chat and Chew's cafes all across the state, people were saying the same thing. And along comes somebody who doesn't have a covey of professionals, doesn't have a PR flax surrounding them and big advertising campaigns, and just talks from the heart. That's what people want to hear, and that is, you know, if the Democrats come forward with more people like Victor Morales, we're going to see more of the little D Democrats going for the big D Democratic Party.
Well, Victor Morales, the Democratic Senate candidate, and Jim Hightower, a populist, progressive, and author of the upcoming book, There's Nothing in the Middle of the Road but Yellow Stripes and Dead Armadillos. We want to thank you very much both for joining us. And coming up next, thank you very much.
Thank you, Amy. It's going to be a fun year.
Well, we're looking forward to covering it. Coming up next on Democracy Now!, our Living Democracy segment on war tax resistance, and then Dan Ellsberg will be with us in the studio. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up in just a little while, we'll be speaking with Dan Ellsberg on the nuclear test ban treaty. But right now, well, I hate to be the one to remind you, but on Monday, it's tax day. And millions of Americans are preparing their tax returns. Well, there are some who won't be sending in their checks to the U.S. government, not because they're just procrastinators or, ooh, is it really April 15th? I guess I forgot. But because they're acting on their conscience. We're joined by two of those people right now. We're joined by Karen Marysdaughter of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee and also Andrea Avazian of Western Massachusetts. She's been a war tax resister for 14 years. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Andrea, why don't we begin with you? Why aren't you sending the U.S. government a check?
I'm not sending the U.S. government a check again this year, as I haven't since 1982, because I think the reason is summed up in a little pie chart that I have scotch taped to the wall of my study. And I think that really sums up why I have to do war tax refusal. The pie chart shows where a dollar of our tax money gets spent according to the national federal budget. And it shows very clearly as it's divided up that the past military and the current military expenses receive 52 cents on every tax dollar. Human resources, those programs that actually meet human needs, receive 30 cents on every tax dollar. The government, the general government, receives 12 cents, and physical resources, including all of agriculture, commerce, energy, the transportation and environmental protection agencies, receive 6 cents on every dollar. To me, the figures are absolutely identically reversed from what I wish the priorities were of our federal budget. And until they are reversed, I intend to withhold a portion of my federal income tax every year as a public, nonviolent, visible, direct protest saying that I want to support programs that meet human needs and not past and current military expenses.
Now, you may have a lot of people saying right now, oh, hey, then I don't have to do anything for April 15th. Does this really mean that you have nothing to do around tax time?
I'm very busy around tax time. Starting the first of every year, I'm very busy because I am interested in filing a tax return so that I do not commit a federal felony, but in fact only commit a misdemeanor. I do a very planned and well thought out war tax resistance program for me. And what I do is I actually complete to the penny a tax form, the form that is due on April 15th, like everyone else. As a matter of fact, yesterday I mailed it in. So I complete a perfect form that shows down to the penny what the IRS believes I owe them. And then I decide, based on my pie chart, which changes every year depending on the federal budget, what portion of that figure that they believe I owe them I actually will pay. And it corresponds to the current military and past military expenses that are shown on the pie chart. So I'm very busy, like everyone else, filling out a detailed and accurate IRS form. It's just that then I add a letter explaining in great detail why it is that I cannot pay, because of conscience, because of my faith, because of my beliefs in nonviolence and in peace, why I cannot pay the figure that is shown on the bottom of the form. I send that letter to them with a check that is less than what they believe it should be. I send that letter to my local paper and to my senators and representatives.
Karen Marysdotter, you also are a war tax resister up in Maine. How did you decide not to pay the taxes that you believe go to the Pentagon?
The turning point for me was in the early 1980s when I heard a talk about famine going on in Cambodia and was asked to write out a check to support the victims of the famine. And somehow I realized that the taxes I'd paid the year before had helped contribute to that famine by contributing to bombing in Cambodia, and that, in fact, I was not even balancing out the money that I personally had spent to create the famine. I also was outraged by the huge peacetime military buildup that started in the early 1980s and the increased threat of nuclear war, and I felt I could not, in good conscience anymore, pay for killing and pay for vastly outpriced weapon systems that were taking money away from human needs in this country.
So what percentage of your taxes don't you pay?
I don't pay any of my federal income taxes, because no matter how much you send in, even if you sent in a dollar, they would use 52% of it from the military. There is currently no way that the government will allow a taxpayer to earmark and say, I want this money, for example, to go to housing instead of to weapon systems. So I refuse to pay them the whole portion. I take 100% of my taxes, and instead I give it to groups, primarily here in Maine, who are working to meet human needs.
Now, some people might be surprised to hear this percentage, 52%, 22% going to the current military budget, 30% going to the past. First of all, what is the past military budget?
Well, one thing that happens is that when the federal government presents its budget figures, it does a little bit of smoke and mirrors. Prior to the war in Vietnam, when the government presented its federal budget, it only included the general fund. Well, there was a huge outcry about the war in Vietnam, and they decided they needed to cover that up a little. So they started lumping in Social Security funds, which are separate trust funds that are earmarked for a specific purpose. Once they lumped those in, it, of course, made the percentage for the military look smaller and the percentage for human needs look bigger. When you remove those trust funds, and then when you look at the fact that following every war that the U.S. has been involved in, and then following this huge military budget in the buildup in the 1980s, the national debt has vastly increased. There have been drastic increases. Then budget analysts figure that a certain percentage of the national debt is, in fact, due to military spending. So we calculate a certain percentage of the interest that we're paying on the national debt as being due to military spending.
Andrea Vazian, you pay about half of your taxes. You don't pay, 52%.
Right.
How does the government respond to your letter explaining why you won't pay taxes to the Pentagon every
year? I think Karen would agree, and all the tax resisters nationwide would agree, that it actually is a very effective form of protest, because you don't get ignored. Now, I've spent 20 years engaged in marches and rallies and vigils and sing-outs and die-ins and pray-ins and all kinds of wonderful and important forms of protest. And, you know, sometimes one feels that, you know, the lights are on in nobody's home in terms of the policymakers and the legislators and the people people that you want to turn around and take note that you're there. But with the war tax resistance, they certainly do take note. It's a very effective form of protest because one starts to receive mail, computerized, unsigned letters that say, you're in violation of the law, you sent in a tax return that said you owed this number of dollars and you didn't send that number of dollars. They totally ignore my letter. They don't care about my letter at all. And therefore, we are going to give you this is a warning, and if you don't send in this amount that you owe, plus 15% interest and 5% penalty, which means your fee is now up to XYZ, we will, in fact, take action. And, of course, I never send the money. I have, you know, many of these letters. I was going to say hundreds. I probably have dozens and dozens and dozens of these letters over the years. And I don't take action. I do read them, but I don't send the money. And then after a matter of weeks or months, it's generally months because they're not very efficient and they don't move that fast on claiming the money, they will up the ante and start sending certified letters that say, this is your 10-day notice. We have warned you. You have to pay this money plus your interest and penalty, and if you don't, we will take it from you in one of these ways. When you get the 10-day notice, I generally think you have about 6 months. It takes them about 6 months to act on the 10-day notice, and then they seize the money. At least that's what's happened to me. Everybody has a different story. First, they try and get it from your bank, so they go to the bank and are a certified agent and can take all the money you owe plus interest and penalty from your bank. They've done that, but I haven't had any money there sometimes. They've also, a number of times in two different jobs, put a lien on my paycheck, which means they get 75% of my paycheck and I get 25% of what I earned. They've also put a lien on my house twice. Because they have seized the money from different places, they have lifted the lien on my house because they've gotten it through my paycheck, where both employers have paid under protest and have made quite a visible and articulate protesting statement, but have paid them.
So they eventually have gotten your money. Karen Murray's daughter, have they gotten yours?
No, they've never gotten any money from me. They've never made a serious attempt to collect from me, even though I've been highly public for the past 15 years since I started this. It varies around the country. There are many war tax resistors who have never had any action taken. There are also many who have had the kind of experience that Andrea has described. For the most part, the action the IRS has taken against people who are conscientiously opposed to war and taking this step because of that is civil penalties and seizing assets. Other kinds of actions are pretty rare.
Andrew, you've had neighbors like Randy Keeler, for example, who served time in jail during the Vietnam War for resisting, who've had their house taken away.
Absolutely. And Randy and Betsy and Lillian had their house seized a number of years ago, and it was, and I think they're very close. Randy is my son's godfather, very close to us. And I think Randy and Betsy and Lillian, I'm not sure if Lillian would say that, but certainly Randy and Betsy would say that it ended up being a very positive experience, although painful and difficult and anxiety-producing. It was an amazing time of organizing solidarity and closeness. The IRS did seize their home. Randy did spend time in jail for resisting that. They, of course, were put out of their home, and Betsy lived in, while Randy was in jail, in someone else's home, I believe, or I think rented an apartment. It was a huge trauma, but it was an amazing rallying point. It raised consciousness. It brought people together. We occupied the house. I was in one of the affinity groups that occupied the house. It was a time of a tremendous amount of consciousness raising and organizing, and we made a very powerful statement to the powers that be that, as we used to sing daily, we shall not be moved, we shall not be defeated. And it strengthened many people's conviction to work against war and violence, and also we got some new converts to the war tax resistance movement.
Karen Murray's daughter, you're with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, which is coordinating dozens of grassroots actions around the United States in this tax season. What are people doing?
One of the main things that people do around tax day is to give away the money that they refuse to pay the government to groups that are working to provide basic human needs, such as housing, health care, education, jobs. and or to groups that are working to promote peace and justice. Last year, the 36 funds that we have around the country gave away a total of $60,000 and loaned out a total of $120,000. And probably the figures this year will be similar to that. That doesn't even count, then, the tax resisters who give their money away directly and not through an alternative fund. But many groups, including our group here locally today, is giving away about $1,250 here in the state of Maine.
Can you tell us about any activities that are taking place?
Yes, there are actions happening in about 50 cities around the country. Another common action is a form of street theater or public displays. So, for example, in St. Louis, the group is going to have a 100-foot graph under the arch in St. Louis that depicts military spending compared to other kinds of spending. The group in Chicago is going to go into the IRS Problems Resolution Office and roll out a graph, again, depicting military spending compared to other spending. The group in Milwaukee is going to actually attempt to occupy the IRS and risk arrest. Many groups, including the one in Eugene, Oregon, do what is known as penny polls, which means they put out jars marked with categories of federal spending and give passersby, say, 10 pennies, and ask them to put the pennies in the jars that they would like to see their money go to. Over the years, every penny poll that has ever happened has shown that taxpayers prefer that their money go to things like education, health care, jobs. Military spending typically comes in at about 6% or 10% or 12%, much lower than what the government is actually spending. And, of course, there will be leafleting of the pie chart that Andrea was mentioning at post offices during the time when people are filing their returns at the last minute.
Let me ask you both something. Right now, we're watching the standoff in Montana between the Freemen and the U.S. government. My question to you is, here you're deciding not to pay taxes based on your own conscience. You don't feel that the federal government should have the authority to take away your money to put into the Pentagon. They, too, feel they have the right not to respect laws that they don't agree with. Do you see any difference between you and them?
I certainly do. And this is Andrea, and I think Karen will respond to this, I hope, as well. War tax resistance, for many of us, is a very public protest that is very engaged with the system. We are working within the system to change the system. We publicly, I should probably say I, because every war tax resister chooses his or her own path and makes a statement in his or her own way. My tax resistance and many of my friends in Western Mass, it's a very public engaged protest. We are working within the system. We are part of the, I am part of mainstream America. I pay my state taxes. I'm involved with my son's school. I am very involved in my community. And the war tax resistance is a public visible way of saying there is, as a person of faith, a higher law that I am following. However, I will engage with you. I certainly have paid the penalties and the fines. I mean, they have been taken from me. And I think there's a difference from the Freemen because we are staying very engaged with the system and trying to change and reform it from within.
I would say that we are a war resistance movement. We're not primarily a tax resistance movement. We are a war resistance movement. We cannot, in good conscience, pay to have someone kill on our behalf. We cannot, in good conscience, see money that should, in fact, be meeting human needs and providing real security in our country being used instead to create dangerous and destabilizing weapons. Tax resistance is one tactic that we as war resistors have chosen to use in order to express our deep conviction that nonviolent action is the only kind of action that is effective and that we can, in good conscience, support.
What about if people start withholding certain amounts of money that they think are going places, for example, that they think are going to support abortion in this country?
I, of course, support the right of people to express their conscience in nonviolent ways. I'm a nonviolent activist, I'm a pacifist, and I support nonviolent forms of social action. We have to point out that abortion is a minuscule portion of the federal budget compared to military spending. So in terms of the amounts of money we're talking about, there's a vast difference. Revenue refusal as a form of nonviolent protest has been a time-honored method used historically, and I think it's a valid protest for people to use.
Let me ask if you've got a number that people can contact if they're interested in the war tax resistance movement. Karen?
Yes, we have an 800 number. It's 1-800-269-7464. 1-800-269-7464.
People can also reach out to the War Resisters League in New York City, 212-228-0450.
Andrea and Karen, thanks for joining us on this Living Democracy segment of Democracy Now! Andrea Vazian of Western Massachusetts, a war tax resister for 14 years. Karen Marysdaughter with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee based in Maine. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, Daniel Ellsberg. After this. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. In this last segment, we're joined by Dan Ellsberg. He came into New York for an event last night at the New School for the 25th anniversary of his leaking of the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other papers. The actual anniversary is June 13th, and we'll be bringing you a Pentagon Papers special on that day. Today, we're going to talk about nuclear weapons and terrorism. Dan Ellsberg is currently director of the Manhattan Project 2, trying to undo the legacy of the original Manhattan Project. Dan, President Clinton is heading to Russia to meet with Russian President Boris Yeltsin in a couple of weeks. He'll be meeting with Yeltsin and the G7 leaders on securing easily smuggled components from Russia's dismantled nuclear arsenal. What do you make of this meeting?
Well, another name for the G7 leaders, so are the slightly smaller group, the permanent members of the Security Council of the UN, are that they are the nuclear terrorist states of the world. They are the nuclear weapon states, so-called, in the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which means that they not only possess nuclear weapons, but every single one of them, with the possible exception of China, reserves the right to initiate nuclear war under circumstances their leaders choose, without any, by the way, legislative or democratic consultation in their own public before they do that in any one case, even those that are democracies like the U.S., without any form of appeal, without any process whatever, their leaders have the right to push buttons that will lead to the indiscriminate slaughter of tens to hundreds of thousands to millions of people. Now, the slaughter of millions of noncombatants, or tens of noncombatants, is terrorism. And every state that possesses nuclear weapons and proclaims an unrestrained right to use those at its own, to threaten them and to initiate their use, is making threats of terrorism, of indiscriminate slaughter, that the states I'm referring to that are in that category of massive terrorist states are the United States, Russia, England, France, China, Pakistan, Israel, and India. They should cease to be terrorist nations. And they can't do that from one day to the next. That would make an enormous change in their attitudes, in their stockpiles, in their postures, in their policies. And it can't happen overnight. But that is what must happen. In a world where terrorism by anyone, whether it's the Unabomber or it's the U.S. in Dresden and Tokyo and Hiroshima in World War II, or Russians, Germans, whoever, or by some small group, sets an example, a precedent of the legitimacy and the usability of terrorism by other people. And it's doing that in a world in which other people are finding it increasingly and will find it increasingly easy to get hold of material that's perfect for terrorism. Small amounts, handful sizes of fissile material that can be made into crude nuclear weapons that can give us a Oklahoma City explosion on the scale of 1,000. That capability is getting increasingly available around the world as it leaks from the former Soviet Union, something that's already started happening and could become a flood. That's not a world in which the nuclear states can afford continually, arrogantly and proudly to set an example of the usability, the legitimacy of nuclear terrorist threats. So that's really a stance we've got to come off of. I can tell you, I'm sure, that will not be, as of now, on the agenda of this anti-terrorism summit between Clinton and Yeltsin. But the world has to change. It won't change unless people in the grassroots who aren't blinded by this power of being commander-in-chief of nuclear terrorist forces, very heady, heady way to be, a godlike feeling that you have in your hand, the life and death of millions of people. If you have ordinary people in all countries who haven't been blinded by that experience, have got to insist that with the Cold War over, we finally wake up from this nightmare and change that precedent, then we could begin to get the problem of nuclear terrorism under control.
How does the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty fit into this?
It would be only the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. It would be a first step. It would be one step toward symbolizing, first of all, in a very powerful way, that we are ceasing to rely on the use and the development of nuclear weapons, that process is over, that the world, led by the superpowers, is moving away from the development and the design of nuclear weapons. In itself, it doesn't end that process for anybody. You can design Hiroshima-type weapons now without testing, period. There are things that it would accomplish more substantively than that. India and Pakistan currently now can only threaten tens of thousands of deaths in each other with Hiroshima-type weapons or Nagasaki. If they started testing, and they will if we don't come up with a test ban quickly, they'll have H-bombs. And I happen to know from experience here, most of the readers, our listeners, don't really have in their minds the difference between an A and an H-bomb. It's the difference between an Oklahoma City explosion and a Hiroshima explosion. It's a difference of a factor of 1,000. It's another 1,000 over the Hiroshima. That would make a difference, and it is worth keeping H-bombs out of the hands of new countries. But still, it's just one step on the way. What's more significant is that the refusal to end testing after a 30-year worldwide effort to get those tests stopped, a refusal by all the states and a failure to sign that ban would symbolize to the world very realistically what is a current reality? That the leaders of these states have no intention ever of giving up nuclear weapons or their reliance on it. And when that message gets out unmistakably, other people will be acquiring those weapons at a rapid rate.
Well, where does the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty stand now?
We stand closer to it than ever before in the last 30 years of effort to stop it. Every single one of the nuclear weapons states agreed a year ago at the Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference, made what was called a political commitment, which they carefully refrained from making a legally binding commitment. But they made a political commitment to produce a comprehensive test ban this year, 1996. It was a dated promise, relatively specific. There's a 50% chance we'll get that. Every one of them still says, we want it. It's at the top of our priorities. That's a lie. It's not the top of their priorities. It's moving slowly. It's being bogged down by states like France and now even India, which is won't even admit they have nuclear weapons, but they do, are slowing up the process because they do want to test in the future without even admitting they have the weapons yet. So Clinton has so far is, I think, in certain sense, committed to a test ban. I mean, that's what people say in the White House. Well, that's the way he gets committed to anything. What? Marriage? I don't know what. But it means you have a chance to get this out of him with enough pressure. And if we put the kind of pressure on Clinton that other interest groups do, let's say, usually with more success, we really do have a chance of getting this. That would not be true under Dole, by the way. Dole doesn't pretend to want a test ban, nor does the Republican Party. They're against it.
Why?
So that's a good question. How can you be against it? It's mad. It's crazy. But that's their position.
Well,
I actually wouldn't find that easy to explain.
I suppose they would say
people who want testing? Yes, there are the people at the labs. They've kind of given up now to a certain extent, but not altogether. So the people whose lives have and prestige and income and careers and influence in the government has entirely depended for 50 years now on the design of nuclear weapons aren't at the nuclear weapons labs at Livermore and Los Alamos and various people in the Pentagon, the Department of Energy, and every counterpart in every one of the other countries. There's a nuclear weapons lab complex in every one of these countries. All of them want nuclear weapons to continue forever. If you're asking me, why are they as influential as they are, that's not easy to answer.
Is there a powerful nuclear weapons lobby in Washington?
There is and always has been, and part of its power has been the secrecy surrounding it. They've kept the design of nuclear weapons, and I have to admit, that's a secret that I am not anxious to see spread around necessarily, but they have used the secrecy surrounding that design to develop a mystique. We are the nuclear priesthood. By the way, that's a phrase they use of themselves, the brotherhood, the priesthood, to have a mystique so that when they say, we know what's good for the country, and we know this has to keep happening, it's hard for most people to argue with them. They have the secret data, and you know, but it has come about over 30 years that enough former members of the priesthood and others have broken away to bring a comparable expertise on the other side and see through that and say, look, this is nonsense.
Since you're active in this worldwide movement for a nuclear test ban treaty, what do you say to countries that say, listen, if the U.S. has it, if Russia has them, if Israel has them, if India has them, although they're not saying it, you have no right to tell us we shouldn't have them. In fact, if we have them, it might serve as a better deterrent.
Well, of course, it would be absurd to say that the U.S. government has a right to tell these people that they don't have a right. The U.S. and the other nuclear states have no moral, ethical, normative, authoritative position on this in saying to the rest of the world, you have no need, no right, no legitimacy to get this stuff, whereas we need thousands of weapons forever. We need the right to continue testing and so forth. Of course, that's an absurd position. Now, I'm not saying it to these people as a member of the U.S. government. I would be ashamed, embarrassed to try to do that. But I do speak as a member of an informed public around the world, which realizes that following the example, the fatal example of the U.S. and Russia and Japan and China and the others, there's a lot of experience to go on to say that that will not improve their national security, that it will indeed simply mainly induce their neighbors to acquire such weapons for the same reasons and on the same basis, and they will not end up with greater security as a result of that. Now, simply refraining from it will not protect them either, but they can take part in a worldwide movement as non-nuclear states, and a lot of them are doing this, to press the nuclear states to change their policy so that we get everybody stopped, so that we have one set of rules for everybody. Then their security will be better.
What is your assessment of President Clinton's Secretary of Energy, Hazel O'Leary? And, of course, the Department of Energy oversees many of the nuclear weapons plants in this country.
Well, I think she's terrific. She's up until last year when she began to get this a very focused barrage of bad publicity about our trips and so forth, which I can't judge, frankly. It does look as though she used bad judgment bureaucratically on that, and it may sully one's judgment of her as a head of a department or something. I really don't know much about it. But prior to that, I would say this is the first person who's telling the truth about her department, who's being open, who she was the only person in his cabinet, the only person at cabinet level, a man or woman, who opposed beginning testing again as soon as legislation permitted him to do that in June of 1993, 3 years ago, without Hazel O'Leary and a strong grass movements and a congressional movement, we would be testing right now. So she's been a very good influence.
Could a GOP Congress turn around the ban on nuclear testing now?
Very much so, definitely. As I said, critical to our... We would be testing now and would have been under Clinton for the last 3 years were it not for a Democratic Congress earlier, which managed to stop testing even under Bush. They cut off the funding for the Bush, and they did it in a quite clever bureaucratic way, which got Bush to not to veto it. And but he did mean to change it eventually. Then he was taken out of office. Clinton would have changed it then on the advice of his Defense Department, his State Department, his National Security Council, were it not for the, least of all in a way, the opposition of Hazel O'Leary, who wasn't very influential at that time, but above all for strong senatorial opposition, which in turn reflected grassroots. Now, that middle link has backed out now.
In fact,
we don't have the congressional lobby to back.
Wasn't that the only major foreign policy difference between President Bush and candidate Clinton when they were running against each
the
other?
The only foreign policy difference that he really proclaimed. Remember that it's necessary to remember this. Clinton did not promise change on foreign policy, and he had no intention of delivering it. And it's not what he ran on, and not what he believes in. He ran as a representing the kind of Democrats who thought the only way we'll ever get the White House is by being as close to the Republicans as possible on military spending and on intervention and hawkish things. And he was prepared to deliver that. But he had one change. He said he was for a comprehensive test ban. That was close to a lie, as these things go. What became very clear was that there was no commitment whatever to a test ban. And nevertheless, thanks to having Clinton rather than Bush, the response to our grassroots pressure in this country and worldwide has been such under Clinton that we do have a good chance of getting a test ban if we keep the pressure up.
Dan Ellsberg, I want to switch gears for a second, and we just have about 2 minutes. You leaked the Pentagon Papers, the thousands of pages of papers that revealed what the Pentagon was doing in Vietnam almost 25 years ago. You worked for the Pentagon. You worked for the RAND Corporation. We were talking earlier about this possibility of a new Pentagon paper, something that you're quite interested in. This doesn't have to do with nuclear weapons or nuclear power, but something else that some might say is equally deadly.
Well, I'm very impressed, inspired, encouraged by the example of the people in the who were in the tobacco industry, who finally, after the kind of lifetime that I'd led in the national security work, came to realize that we were wrong to keep promises of secrecy when what was being concealed and lied about were wrongful criminal policies that were indiscriminately killing. I've talked about nuclear weapons as indiscriminately killing civilians. Sending out, you know, tons and tons of cigarettes into the country doesn't tell the cigarette companies exactly who will be killed, but it does tell them how many will be killed. It is indiscriminate, random slaughter. And they've been getting away with it. And what turns out is, of course, that they've known exactly what they were doing, just as the Pentagon Papers revealed that our leaders knew what they were getting into, knew that they were getting into a situation that would do us no good but would lead to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And that to reveal that knowledge did undermine the policy. Now that the so-called cigarette papers... And there's a book by that title, I think, coming out very shortly.
Is it cigarette papers or tobacco papers?
Well, the copy I got in advance calls them the cigarette papers.
Uh-huh.
Others have called them the tobacco papers. Both call them the Pentagon Papers, and that's a counterpart. And that's absolutely accurate. In fact, it's the same amount. It's 4,000 pages they're putting out of inner documentation about what the tobacco corporations knew and when they knew it. And it's very guilty knowledge.
And we're going to be talking more about the tobacco industry next Tuesday when we devote our entire show to tobacco interests and their massive power over presidential candidates. Right now, I want to thank you, Dan Ellsberg, for joining us, director of the Manhattan Project 2, that's trying to counter the legacy of the Manhattan Project 1 in World War II. Dan Ellsberg, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow on the show, Robert Sweet. He's against mandatory minimums and for drug decriminalization, and he's a federal judge. Also, a debate on third-party politics leading into this weekend's third-party conference in Atlanta. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer at WBAI in New York is Matthew Finch with help from Grayson Challenger and Paul Wunder. Our director has been Errol Maitland. Again, if you'd like a copy of today's show, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to write to us by email, you can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Join us tomorrow for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!